6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Hurricane Irma is battering its way at Haiti and Dominican Republic with fierce winds, heavy rain. Forecasters are saying Irma's next target is Cuba and the Bahamas. Mike Brennan is with the U.S. National Hurricane Center. He explains that Irma most likely will hit the U.S. on the southern coast of the state of Florida.
The new track forecast is a little to the left of our previous one and now takes the storm inland over the Florida Peninsula, making landfall as a major hurricane somewhere in the vicinity of South Florida on Sunday. There's still some uncertainty as to where this northward turn will occur, but everyone in South Florida should be preparing for the landfall of a potentially catastrophic major hurricane in the area on Sunday.
Irma does remain a Category 5 storm, 280 kilometer per hour winds. During a press conference, President Trump at the White House was asked if it's inevitable military action will take place against North Korea.
Military action would certainly be an option. Is it inevitable? Nothing's inevitable. It would be great if something else could be worked out. We would have to look at all of the details, all of the facts.
After the president's comments, a senior Trump administration official expressed concern that North Korea cannot be deterred from pursuing its missile and nuclear programs. President Trump told 800,000 young undocumented immigrants in the U.S. that they have nothing to worry about regarding deportation during the next 6 months while Congress works on a plan to allow them to permanently stay in the country. Mr. Trump had rescinded former President Barack Obama's program that allowed the immigrants to study and work in the U.S. and serve in the military. This is VOA News. Two Turkish-American men were involved in a brawl in the Turkish embassy in Washington earlier this year. Well, now they've pleaded not guilty to assault charges. 18 people, many of whom were members of the Turkish ambassador's security detail, were indicted for allegedly attacking protesters outside the ambassador's residence on May the 16th. All 18 were charged with conspiracy to commit a crime of violence, felony that is punishable by a maximum of 15 years in prison. Several faced additional charges of assault with a deadly weapon. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis met with the Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmed al-Jaber al-Azabah, at the Pentagon during a briefing that was open to the media. Mattis said Azabah expressed their mutual commitment to work together against extremism and to continue to strengthen the bond between the two countries.
Kuwait has stepped forward in its usual way, but this has been an exceedingly difficult mission for the Emir, and we're grateful for his leadership. And I look forward to discussing how we can further advance our country's military relationship in the coming months and years, and in particular exploring ways to increase Kuwait's involvement in the Defeat ISIS campaign.
Today, Kuwait hosts 13,500 American troops, many at a camp south of Kuwait City, which also is home to the forward command of the U.S. Army Central. A U.S. federal appeals court has rejected the Trump administration's limited view of who is allowed into the U.S. under the president's travel ban. VOA's Mary Mata has details.
The court said grandparents, cousins, and other close relations of people in the U.S. should not be prevented from coming to the country. The unanimous ruling from three judges on the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals also said refugees accepted by a resettlement agency should not be banned. The decision upheld a ruling by a federal judge in Hawaii who found the administration's view too strict. The U.S. Supreme Court said in June that President Donald Trump's 90-day ban on visitors from six Muslim-majority nations can be enforced pending arguments scheduled for October. But the justices said it should not apply to visitors who have a bona fide relationship with people or organizations in the U.S. Mary Mata, VOA News, Washington.
And in an emotional speech before thousands gathered in Colombia's capital, Bogota, Pope Francis said young people represented hope for reconciliation in that country, ravaged by decades of guerrilla fighting and divisions by the anger some Colombians have over the government's peace deal with FARC.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Friday, September the 8th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Gunmen shot and badly wounded Tanzania's most outspoken opposition figure Thursday near his home in the capital, Dodoma. The attack shocked the East African nation, known for its relative peace and stability. And more than 300 Burundian refugees have been repatriated back to the country. The exercise is expected to continue until the end of this year.
We are sending them to Ruyigi. It will be 60 families, which makes 199 refugees. Then Bujumbura will be 37 families.
And the Africa Green Revolution Forum is being held this week in Abidjan. It is a place where policymakers, private sector leaders, and civil society gather to discuss best ways to promote sustainable agriculture and economic growth. And with little over a month before Liberians head to the polls, the country is gripped by campaign fever as about 20 presidential candidates canvass for votes.
This is the time that Liberia and Liberians are looking for real change in our country.
Charles Bromskine is the presidential candidate for the Liberty Party in Liberia. We will bring you his interview with VOA's James Batty later on in the show. And Uganda is working on improving its energy sector so as to improve industrialization of the country. Those stories plus Africa Sports Roundup are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Gunmen shot and badly wounded Tanzania's most outspoken opposition figure Thursday in the country's capital. Lawmaker Tundu Lissu of the Chadema Party, who recently faced criminal charges after he called President John Magufuli a dictator, was wounded by an unknown assailant in Dodoma. Tanzanian President Magufuli condemned the shooting and ordered the country's security forces to investigate the incident. In July this year, Lissu was criminally charged with using abusive language after he called Magufuli a dictator over alleged attacks on the opposition and the media. Magufuli has faced growing accusations by rights groups and others of not tolerating criticism since he was elected in 2015. Live transmission of parliamentary debates has been stopped and opposition rallies have been banned until the next election cycle in 2020. In a statement, Amnesty International called for Tanzanian government to investigate the attack and, quote, reassure Tanzanians and the world that this shooting was not politically motivated. It is 32 more days before Liberians go to the poll on October 10 to elect a new president to succeed Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first elected female president. The country is gripped by campaign fever as about 20 presidential candidates canvass for votes. Charles Bromskine is the presidential candidate for the Liberty Party. He is seeking the presidency for the third time since 2005. Mr. Bromskine will officially launch his campaign in Monrovia, the capital, tomorrow, Saturday. VOA's James Batty and host of Daybreak Africa is in Liberia for the election. He asked Mr. Bromskine what exactly would be his message for the voters on Saturday amid serious economic problems in the country.
This is the time that Liberia and Liberians are looking for real change in our country. We've had so many years of war. Ellen Sirleaf and Joe Barker have served well in a transition period. It's time to begin Liberia anew. Our message is reconciling our people, reforming the way we do things in this country, recovering our ancient values, and building the infrastructure of our nation.
This is the third time that you are seeking the presidency of Liberia. I had an opportunity yesterday to visit the Red Light Marketplace, and much of what I heard was that the economy of this country is on their mind. Some of the market women, I sat down with them on their market stools, and they were telling me
that sometimes they find it very difficult to make ends meet. They can't support their family. Their children cannot go to school because they can't pay the tuition. So I want you to speak to those people in that marketplace. How would their life be different if Councillor Charles Bromski is elected president?
We're going to change the economic paradigm of this country. What the Unity Party has done, they have basically relied upon the economic policies inaugurated by President Tubman in the 50s and the 60s. They depended on the extractive industry as source of revenue for government. What we will do, we will diversify the economy, that it put more investment in the agriculture sector, where a substantial portion of our population live. They are non-subsistence farmers. We must help them to become commercial farmers. We will also invest more money in education in this country here. Right now, the Liberian government invests about 7% of national budget on education. We look forward to investing a little more than that, gradually moving to doubling that amount over the next few years. And we're going to establish schools all throughout this country, and all government schools are going to be free of charge. So that market woman you spoke of will be able to send her children to school without having to be worried about school fees. We're also going to take on the responsibility of paying the WAC exam fees for all of our students in this country, so that children who are from indigent parents will not miss out on school because they cannot pay their WAC exam fee.
As I mentioned, this is your third time running for president. What do you think are your chances now of winning this election? So in that sense, let me ask you, do you feel at this stage in the campaign where there are 32 or 33 days to go before the election, is your stock rising or is your stock lowering? How do you see yourself?
I think our chance is better now than it's ever been. And using your words, our stock is rising.
Do you feel, Councillor Bromski, that some of you, the candidates, have now tried to frame this campaign along tribal lines? Because I think somebody was telling me that on your campaign trail, you must have said that, it's about time now that a Bassa person wins or become president. So many people have become president for so long. Are you guys trying to tribalize this election to say
no,
that?
No. I mean, I think what I have said have been deliberately taken the context. This is not the time for a Bassa person to be president. I would not say that. There are over 200,000 people in Grand Bassa County, where I'm from. I want all of them being president. This is the time for Charles Walker Bromski to be president. I just happen to be a Bassa person.
This is your third time, Councillor. What would you do if you do not win? Would you be willing to support another candidate?
You know, Jimmy, I'm doing everything reasonably possible to win, and I have not arrived at that second part of your question yet. So right now, we're concentrating on winning.
So before I let you go, Councillor, how much are you worth, and have you declared your assets?
Yes, we have declared our assets to the Election Commission. I'm not a wealthy man, but I'm pretty comfortable. Okay, I believe my asset in excess of $1 million.
$1 million?
Yes, I believe that. I have to check with my wife, who happens to be the accountant.
Councillor, it's been a pleasure talking with you as usual.
Charles Bromski is the presidential candidate of the Liberty Party of Liberia. He was speaking with VOA's James Batty, who is in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, for that country's October 10 presidential election. The African Green Revolution Forum is being held this week in Abidjan. It's a place where policy makers, private sector leaders, and civil society gather to discuss best ways to promote sustainable agriculture and economic growth. Osman Badian, Africa Director for the International Food Policy Research Institute, tells Ricky Shryok about what's happening at this year's forum.
the broader agenda around trade, around investment, around celebrating the progress that took place in Africa, but being cognizant of the many more challenges that remains in the areas of investment, infrastructure, agribusiness development, trade, and the like. There's also the opportunity for AGRA to release its annual report. They had major rounds with several heads of state and leading agribusiness private sector people, as well as development agencies, discussing how they would like to do their partnership, their FACPA, in order to achieve even better outcomes in Africa. Yes, okay, I was going. There was one major report that was presented here by what they call the Malabo Montpellier panel, which I co-chair with my colleague, Professor Joachim von Braun from the University of Bonn. The panel presented a report on nutrition, not just the status of nutrition and challenges around advancing nutrition in Africa, but it did something that you don't see very often. It looked at where countries are making progress on nutrition. And the seven countries that have been able to reduce malnutrition levels by 40 to 60% over the last 10 years. And the question was now, what did they do right? How did they did it? And with what? Basically trying to distill lessons from those countries and spread the word and share them with other countries so that that success can be replicated.
A lot of times when I meet farmers on the continent, their main problems are that, you know, some of the aid or the help that's being given to them are like very simple tools, actually. And they tell me, I need a tractor. I need industrial equipment. And there is none. Are they correct? Is that the case? Is there a need for that with the farmers in, I'm talking about mostly West Africa?
Well, I think it's well understood all over Africa that you cannot continue farming without embracing improved technologies, and that includes equipment. There's no question about that. But the one thing is knowing the need of it, and another thing is how do you do that? I don't think you can go around and distribute tractors to farmers. People think in terms of the value chain. If you get the tractor and produce something else, where is it sold? How is it processed? How is packaged and how is it distributed? Are the other actors in that chain also operating? Are they connected? Is the market mechanism working? So there are a lot of things that go around. And then once you have all of that in place, you still have the issue of if you have the tractor, do you have the professions around the tractor business? It's just not, you didn't drive a tractor like the way you drive a car.
That was Osman Badian, Africa Director for the International Food Policy Research Institute. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Abidjan. The UN Refugee Agency has started repatriating hundreds of Burundian refugees back home from the neighboring Tanzania. At least 12,000 Burundian refugees have signed up for voluntary repatriation. Yesterday, 300 Burundians arrived back into the country, with more to be repatriated every week. More than 240,000 Burundian refugees are sheltering in Tanzania. Most of them fled political violence in 2015 after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced plans to seek a disputed third term. From Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana has this report.
It was around midday, Burundi local time, when five buses carrying Burundi refugees arrived at the Gisuru border in Ruigi province, located in the eastern part of Burundi. Men, women and children were escorted by Tanzanian authorities to safely hand them over to the Burundian officials. Nukamazina Mark was among the Burundian refugees who voluntarily registered to be repatriated from Tanzania. He fled the country in 2015 when violent protests erupted in Bujumbura.
First of all, we want to at least get where we can farm, because I can't do any work other than farming. Another thing is where to stay, because I used to stay in Bujumbura where I rented the house, and now it's no more. So we plead to the government to help us in that.
According to the Burundian government, more than 150,000 Burundian refugees
were repatriated without the help of the UNHCR. The Burundi government had accused the UNHCR of delaying the repatriation of the refugees who had already registered voluntarily to be repatriated. Teras Nahiraja is the spokesman of the Burundi Home Affairs Minister.
For me, I tell those Burundians who are in Tanzania, who are saying that in Burundi there is no peace, to come and see. And I call on UNHCR, Burundi and Tanzanian government to do visiting missions so that they can go and inform the others how secure the country is.
The UNHCR mandate for the voluntary repatriation have been refined and extended from the initial consideration that the UNHCR's responsibility ended when repatriants crossed the border back into their home country, to a substantive involvement with the regard to facilitating to securing protection and providing assistance to returnees in the country of origin. The Tanzanian government had last month gave the UNHCR 7 days to put everything in place for the refugee repatriation. Emmanuel Maganga, the local administrator of Kigoma in Tanzania, said that only those who voluntarily registered to repatriate will be facilitated and no refugee will be forced to go back home.
We are sending them to Ruyigi, to be 60 families, which makes 199 refugees. Then Bujumbura will be 37 families. The data we have as of yesterday, they have reached 12,000 refugees. What I know, the process of registering them is done by the government of Tanzania. That's why you are talking of 12,000 numbers.
The UNHCR representative in Burundi, Mbilingi, said that the UNHCR is working with Burundi government in establishing reception centers where refugees will be received and that will be provided with food and shelter for at least 3 months, from which others will be able to join their families or help to integrate in the community. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Uganda is working on improving its energy sector so as to improve industrialization of the country. Energy Minister Irene Muloni says increasing electricity supply will help reduce the cost of production and increase government gross domestic product, or GDP. Muloni says the country will also generate revenue by exporting energy to some of the neighboring countries. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
Minister Muloni says Uganda will double the electricity it produces to almost 2,000 megawatts in the next 2 years. She says energy will help Uganda to develop faster and become a middle-income economy in the next 5 years.
Right now we have two big hydropower projects, Karuma, 600 megawatts, Isimba, 183 megawatts. They are going on construction right now. Next year, August, we expect Isimba to be commissioned. Towards the end of the year, we expect Karuma to also commence commissioning. These are going to add almost 800 megawatts. Right now, we are standing at about 950 megawatts. So in the next 1.5 years, we are actually going to double the energy generation in this country.
Muloni says electricity, just like any other goods and services, can earn an income for the economy.
Any excess which our country will not be utilizing, we will be able to get money from it by selling it to the other members in the region. That puts us at an advantage as a country because we are in the middle. We are getting interconnected to the different countries. And so once we set up a power pool, then whatever we generate, if our internal needs are met in excess, we can look for market for it.
Uganda already exports electricity to neighboring Kenya and Rwanda. But Mulon says once the above projects are complete, Uganda will sell its electricity to other countries, including DR Congo, South Sudan, Djibouti, and Egypt. She says Uganda also plans to use clean energy such as geothermal and solar, especially in rural areas.
Nuclear energy is one of the renewable energy sources that we are pursuing as a country. Our strategic plan is still on. We have actually moved the roadmap in trying to put it in place. Studies have been going on. We've identified places in this country where these nuclear plants can be located for purposes of safety and environment and so on and so forth.
Mulone says Uganda has already negotiated with Russia, South Korea and China to help develop nuclear energy by the year 2025. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa Sports. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the regional West African Football Union Cup of Nations, scheduled to begin tomorrow in Ghana. The regional football tournament, featuring only locally based players, will see 16 teams from West Africa compete for the trophy. Ghana FA President Kwesi Nyataki says everything has been put in place to stage a spectacular tournament.
Many other teams are arriving today and tomorrow. The last team that will arrive will be Nigeria. They are ending their league on the 8th and they will arrive here on the 9th. So their fixture has been rescheduled in order to accommodate their late arrival. So I can confirm to you all arrangements have been made to ensure a successful tournament.
Mali coach Elian Girisi has resigned from his post barely 24 hours after a barren draw against Morocco and 5 days after a 6-0 drubbing at the hands of Morocco in a day 4 clash of the 2018 FIFA World Cup Russia qualifiers almost ended the Los Angeles qualifications hopes. The result leaves Mali at the depth of Group C with just 2 points from 4 games, 5 shy of leaders Cote d'Ivoire. The 65-year-old Frenchman feels activities around the national team has become complicated for him. From West Africa to South Africa, where the South African Football Association wants to challenge the decision by FIFA to order a replay of the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier between South Africa and Senegal. The result of the match played in November last year in Polokwane, which South Africa won 2-1, has been nullified. According to FIFA, this decision follows the confirmation of the Court of Arbitration for Sports to uphold the lifetime ban of Ghanaian match referee Joseph Lamptey for match manipulation. South Africa Football Association President Danny Jordan says Bafana Bafana cannot be punished for something they did not do, hence the appeal.
It's 10 months after the match. Consistently over the 10 months, those 3 points were reflected in all the league's logs that FIFA put out. Came as a surprise. At the back of all of the matches, which was already played on Wednesday, on Thursday there is a decision that has impact on the results up to Wednesday. But those are matters that our legal committee will have to look at.
Staying with football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, will send an 8-man inspection team led by Second Vice President Constant Omari for a final assessment of the country's preparedness for next year's African Nations Championship CHAN on Monday, September the 11th. This is after the initial inspection tour, which had been set for Thursday, September 7th, was aborted due to what was reported as the country's political situation. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington, and do have a lovely weekend.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Friday, September the 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again Monday morning for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a three-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania. Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the Road with Shaka, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.